Changing times and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is June 25th, 2026. This is episode 3860 of the Survival Podcast. I just look at that number and go, so we're 140 episodes. It's a lot, but very much in striking distance. 140 episodes, and we will hit episode 4,000. That's pretty amazing. What are we going to talk about in today's episode, though, is what's important. It is Thursday. That means there is no live stream, no video, just an audio-only show of the Expert Council. Here's who I got for you today. For the first time ever on TSP, G. Edward Griffin, along with Dr. Ron Paul. They're going to talk about a subject that, for you know, Ron Paul's group, I'm glad to see something other than Iran come up. The Fed is a cartel of the biggest banks. Its actions are for the benefit of the cartel. So I think it's a great segment and one really germane to our lives. We need to understand this. And it's kind of cool that I'm actually going to have G. Edward at least heard on the Survival Podcast. He probably didn't know that was going to happen when he gave this interview to Dr. Paul, but such is the relationship we have with the folks over there at Liberty Report, Dr. Paul Damick Adams and Chris Rossini. And just a special thank you to Chris today, because Chris is the one that got the approval with Dr. Paul to do this several years ago and does all the work to make sure that we have segments every week. And man, Chris never lets me down. Occasionally takes a vacation, but everybody's entitled to that. I never don't get a segment from Chris unless he's out of the country or something. Patrick Rohrman was asked a question about a knife sharpening system called the Tumbler system. He mentions me in this segment, and he's righter than he knows, and I'll give my add-on to this. There's times when Patrick very much old school, sharpen with your whetstone type guy or your, you know, really high end belt sharpener or something like that. Like, so we disagree on like the Ken Onion, like small belt sharpener. I think it's a fantastic sharpener. He doesn't like it. In this case, we agree, and I might actually be more negative than he is. Joel Riles will talk about dealing with a dog that gets dog on dog aggressive. And I'm going to give a little caveat here because we don't really know what happened in this incident. It didn't go really bad or anything, but there was a dog-on-dog aggression thing. Person wants to know how to handle it. And they said what people always say about their dogs, it came out of nowhere. And Joel points out that it didn't come out of nowhere because dogs always kind of telegraph what they're going to do in advance. But I would say that sometimes, in some situations, you have a moving part on both sides. And this person's dog may, in fact, have not signaled anything was wrong until the other dog did something wrong. And I want to talk about the added lesson of that, not how it changes anything Joel has to say here, because Joel certainly knows more than me about training dogs. I guarantee you that. Then we're going to move on, and we're going to hear from Andy McCann on something called sarcopenia. I think is how you say it. Basically, that as we get older, we lose muscle and bone mass. Is that a natural thing? Andy says no. I say no, but, and the medical establishment says yes. We'll talk about that today. Doc Bones will talk about thoughts on antibiotics for emergencies now that you can't just order a giant bottle of fish amoxicillin. And then I have one for you. Somebody sent me this post from LinkedIn, and it was inspired by an article in the Washington Post. I have links to both of those in the show notes. The Post article is paywalled, so I immediately found a way around the paywall. I have the non-paywall version where you can take a look at it, because trust me, it ain't worth paying for. But the concept is interesting, and it is, the article was about how educators are alarmed. Oh, dear God, not an educator being alarmed. Not that. Not a hero who doesn't wear a cape being alarmed. Anyway, educators are alarmed because students are speeding through online degrees, like getting four-year typical degrees in a matter of months, not just like 1 year, but like literal months. In some cases, really, like you might measure it in weeks. And it's presented from the angle of, but students are just showing what they already know, but they're using AI to do it. Okay, yeah. I think there's a multitude of things here. But the bigger question, and the question that is brought up by the person who made the LinkedIn post, is will AI itself, regardless of this whining, bitching, gnashing of teeth by the establishment who realizes we're losing our cash cow, boys, will it accelerate that? We know the college university system's in trouble. I've talked about it for over a decade. I have been proven right over and over again. Right about the dawn of the COVID years, I said that you would, in the coming years, start to see news articles saying, you know, X and X college that's been around for 85 years is closing its doors or selling off part of its campus, or these larger state schools will be closing, you know, campuses, like the second tier campuses. For instance, you know, one of the schools I thought about going to when I was in school, because I went to Pennsylvania High School, was Penn State. And, you know, if I would have stayed home, I probably wouldn't have went to Penn State University, at least in the first couple of years. There's a Penn State school campus much nearer to my home that I would have maybe done my first 2 years in. It doesn't exist anymore. Like, tons of people I went to school with took that route to begin their education with Penn State, and that just a kid graduating from my high school today doesn't even have the option. So all that came to pass. And what we've seen over the years is a declining value in something that continues to go up in price and somehow doesn't explode. This is like saying you have dry water, okay? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all, except that we lived in an inverted fiat world with guaranteed money. But that is starting to dry up. And we've talked about that issue enough, but the dawn of AI, I'm going to talk about how this might actually accelerate the demise of the university system. Not all of it. I'm going to break the university system into four classifications right now and talk about which groups of those are most at risk. But I'm going to frame it this way. You can kind of chew on this until we get back to my segment as we listen to the other expert counsels today. If I'm running a company, and I mean a big company, I'm running a company the size of Google or HP, you know, or some other large company, a company that measures its sales in billions, right, or even hundreds of billions of dollars. And I need people to do certain things, and I could literally take my own people that are like two levels above that and have them use AI and develop a training program that would be online and very low cost or free to take and come with, like, let's say, oh, a guaranteed job interview. That's the guarantee you get if you get through the course. And the people that I hired then would have had proven proficiency, right? Because we wouldn't be asking them to answer questions so much as to do work. We literally would train them to do the work that they were going to do using AI in a simulation. Like, it would just be like they are at the office, working in the office, doing the things they need to do. And then when those people came out of that program, which I could spin up every time I had a new demand for more than one or two, if it's one or two people, like if I need a CFO or something, I'm not going to do this. But your entry level and like your second tier stuff, your stuff is like one layer above entry level, where that giant funnel of overturn comes, and I bring people in there, and then I develop them internally. If I can do that, then why would I want somebody to have a college degree? Or another way to put it, if I can do that, wouldn't the person that went through that be more valuable to me than the person with a college degree? And another way to look at it, if I can do that, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I? Now, there's some things, you know, we talked about with Jesse yesterday that you have to be mitigated. Like, I don't really want to train them on anything truly proprietary or unique to my organization, but I certainly can build training that makes them, let's say, 85% where I want them to be, you know, 6 months into their job. And if I can do that on day one, then I can probably get them to where I want them at 6 months in like 6 days. Why wouldn't I do that? And the answer is there's no good reason for me not to do that. And I think this is going to be one of those unforeseen, obvious uses of AI for corporations. They're already using AI to interview people in a really stupid way. I mean, I'll talk more about it when we get to my segment, but literally the AI camera is examining how well you hold eye contact, but with a camera? This doesn't make any sense, but this is what they're doing. Companies are hiring people who are using AI slop, and the companies are using AI slop to hire the AI slop using employees. And I think some of that's going on in this kind of run through your degree really fast stuff too. But it doesn't mean it has to be that way. And the one thing we know about technologies is that for-profit companies eventually have to figure out how to use those technologies to the best end of the company's goal, which is to make money. So we are not going to have all headcount cut to zero by AI. We're not going to have a company the size of HP run by 12 people. Maybe a company that traditionally had a headcount of 50,000 will become a company with a headcount of 30,000. That's still a lot of people. Maybe they'll even become a company with a headcount of 50% less, 25,000. But if that's the case, if you see cuts down into from a 50,000 like a 25,000, somewhere in that 20 to 25 range, I'll just bet you that a lot of those people are what we've already talked about. They were hired for no real reason in the first place. During the cheap money years where everybody was hiring and having headcount races just to make the stock price go up. If you have, what I'm saying is if you had a company with 50,000 people and the majority of those people are actually useful in the business and necessary for the business, you can cut down to 30,000. But that's still a lot of people. And we still need people. And we actually need people that are better people who are willing to do more because we gave them a tool that lets them do more. We really don't need people to ask ChatGPT to write me an empathetic email to my supplier. We need people to perform critical functions in the business and use AI to implement those solutions. And this is so dramatically different that the university system simply cannot adapt to it, nor does it benefit anybody for them to do so. So again, when we get to this segment, I'll split the people that go to college into four groups as to the value of the degree after they get out. And then we'll talk about which ones will be hit the hardest by this new adder to an already dying system. With that, before we get into it today, I just want to remind you that on Tuesday next week, Laws of Life Book 2 drops. Really, I would love it if you guys would help me make a big splash with it. Pick up a copy or two or three or 10 on day one. Why would I buy more than one, Jack? Because this is a book you're going to want to give to people. I promise you, it's a book you're going to want to give to people. It will change lives. Book one was okay. Book one, second edition, if I do say myself, myself, is flipping fantastic. Book two will take things to a level for you that you can't imagine with what it can change in your life if you'll give it a shot. So please, give me a shot. Give me a shot. Pick up the book. Send it to a friend. Send it to someone you care about, especially the people you know that are, let's say, 15 to 35 years of age, as long as they're not going to be upset by reading the word shit a couple times because words like that are in there. Anyway, let's move on. Not a lot either. Just, where it's called for. Anyway, let's get on with this. The Fed is a cartel of the biggest banks, and its actions are for the benefit of the cartel itself. Dr. Ron Paul, and for the first time on TSPC, G. Edward Griffin.
I want to ask a question a little bit more specific because we've had a major change at the Federal Reserve. We have a new Federal Reserve Board chairman, and it is that. Some people are saying, hey, this is it, and now we're going to go in a certain direction. But, Warsh is controversial in the thing that, in a way, because nobody knows exactly what he's going to do. And I think there's maybe a reason that that's the case, because I don't think any Federal Reserve chairman knows what they're going to do. But, the big debate going on now and why the markets are even rockier and more chaotic is the fact that there's this big argument about the doves and the hawks. Should the interest rates go up or go down? What's happening? As if they know the answer to this. But do you look at these guys up here, or you brush them off, or you say, no, this guy has a couple good ideas. Maybe he will do something right, or maybe he will accidentally do something right, or maybe he'll make things much worse. Where would you stand on that?
Well, I don't think there's many accidental things happening at the Federal Reserve level, you're quite right. We don't know what the Fed chairmen are going to do, but we do know what they're not going to do. They're not going to save us. They're not going to make matters better. They're not going to restore the economy. They're not going to make our money supply so it's valuable into the future. They're not going to do anything that we want them to do. They're going to do what they have to do because they are, as you know very well, they're a cartel. They're a banking cartel, no different than the banana cartels or the oil cartel. They just have to be a banking cartel, and all cartels only do one thing, and that is to benefit the members of the cartel, period, cold stop. So that's what we know they will do, is to their benefit and not to ours. So it's easy if you really understand the way the game is stacked. But if you think that they're honest people trying to help America and help and protect the economy and worry about the average person and so forth, you're making a big mistake, because that's not the way the real world is.
Right.
Listening to that segment, I could only think of one quote going it over and over and over in my head. And that quote is by Charlie Munger. And that quote is, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. In other words, people follow incentives. And that means companies or corporations or banks or any entity follows incentives, because all of those things are run by people. And when you run a bank, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the entity and the shareholders for the bank to make money and remain solvent. Yeah. Okay, that's the incentive. Make money, remain solvent. That's the actual incentive. Now, the Fed has a mandate, and that mandate is keep inflation to about 2%, because apparently not having inflation is terrible. That's what they say anyway, and to maintain full employment. The Fed has maintained its mandate since it was established in 1913. You know, let's say consecutively over five-year periods, exactly no times. There is no five-year period you can say the Fed did exactly what it was supposed to do under that mandate. And anything approaching that would have been like around the war years or something in the booms of the 50s. If you go from 1971 forward, when the Fed became almighty and the last tethering of the gold standard was removed, so we're talking over 50 years now, 56 years, I guess, to be exact, they've done it exactly zero. I don't think they've pulled off three consecutive years of meeting their mandate. So they have a mandate, right? The thing that they're supposed to do, and then they have a reality in that the thing that they've done. Now, one of those things lines up with the incentive, and the other one fails to line up with the incentive. The Fed maintaining 2% inflation or lower, but not too much lower, and the Fed maintaining full employment, does it maximize profits for the bank? Volatility and the constant movement of money from one asset class to another, the constant need to trade, the constant need to leverage, okay, the constant need to liquidate and replenish, all of those things maximize profits for banks. And if you add a backstop of, no matter how stupid you behave, the government can always print the money because we're the global standard of money, and therefore, no matter how bad we are, we're the least nasty shirt in the hamper, so people have to wear us whether they want to or not. There's a lot of crazy shit you can get away with and maintain your approach to the incentive while ignoring your mandate and claiming that's what you're really going to do. Now, that should make you think of something else, shouldn't it? Another thing, another quote, Stafford Beer. The purpose of the system is what it does. There is no point in worrying about what it claims to do. Yeah? It's basically up there with, like, as a constant rule, it's up there with, like, Pornell's iron law bureaucracy, right? Like, the purpose of the system is what it does. So what does the Federal Reserve System do? It continuously devalues the dollar at the expense of the American people. That means that's what its purpose is. And what that means for you is you have got to do things differently than the system and the people behind the system tell you to do it. Okay? Because they are aligned with an incentive to keep their job and to sound intelligent and important and to be comfortable. That's the incentive that the mouthpieces are following, right? Okay, so none of that helps you. So what helps you? One is investing in assets that are sufficient in appreciation to more than offset the loss to inflation. That means you have to invest your money. You cannot sit on cash. Cash is trash, especially in the corporate space. Okay, but that's not the only thing you have to do. Another thing you have to do to be able to gauge your success of building and developing wealth is, does your purchasing power increase? In other words, what is the power of your net worth today? What can you do with it? If that power over time, and there's dips and bobs and stuff with commodities, but let's say over a 10-year period, if you are not able to do significantly more with your wealth, it doesn't matter how much higher the number is, the dollar is effectively a melting ice cube. We need to understand all of this. And we need to understand that the true incentives are counter to common sense. I am opposed to debt when you buy a TV set with a credit card. When you pay for groceries that you will eat this week with a credit card you will not pay off this year, I am opposed to debt. Large loans on vehicles that do not have an express business purpose that exceeds the cost of the vehicle in the vehicle's ROI, that I am opposed to, right? Because these are ways we burn money. But debt in the form of, let's say, a 3% loan-to-value loan against an asset that generates cash flow that is now tax-free, that is not something everybody should do. And there's times in your life for it and times in your life that are not for doing it. And you have to have a certain amount of wealth before you execute that protocol. But it deserves to be considered and understood so that it can be part of the long-term plan, even if you are far away from it. Because the incentives are literally perverse in our society. And that means that when you approach money only from a common sense mindset, you lose. And if you approach money without a common sense mindset, you also lose. You have to go with common sense and then understand aligned incentives and bring those two together. Because the people in charge of the money, their incentive has nothing to do with your happiness. Therefore, they're not going to act with any of your happiness or anything like that in mind. In fact, the way the Fed acts is a lot like compensation plans are written in highly aggressive sales organizations, where comp plans are not just you get 3% of your sales, because as you build a book of business, eventually you have so much business that you're going to get anyway that your need to hunt new business declines. So they run things like something like an IC factor, meaning that literally you need to sell at least X to make your plan. And let's say your plan is you can make $200,000, and that means you need to sell $2 million worth of shit. Okay. Well, it's very possible that 5 years from then, you might have a quota of $5 million to make $200,000. And if you want to make big money, you'll have to exceed that quota, or that you have to do, you know, open a certain number of new accounts, or in something like an insurance agency, you have to bring in a certain number of new agents every year that actually begin writing business and stick around for more than a few weeks. There's a lot of things like that in predatory sales organizations that we don't want the salesperson to coast, as though you could possibly be coasting when you put in all this effort to build this book of business. And that requires, you know, a firm commitment to farming and managing those accounts as well as hunting new business. They act that way. But really what the incentive is, we just want number to go up no matter what. And instead of saying, well, since this guy's got his shit together, let him make his money and carry his bag and just hire somebody else. No, we're going to force him to do more. Because the company's incentive is pleasing shareholders, not keeping their salespeople happy. Just like the Federal Reserve's incentive is making maximum profit for their bank, not keeping the American people who they supposedly serve happy. See how that works? Because, well, they don't make a profit. Well, first of all, they do. It's called interest. They keep the interest on the payments. But the other side of it is, You don't need to be making a direct profit there if you can create the conditions where your entity itself is guaranteed to profit, which is what they're really doing. All right, moving on from there, let's talk about the tumbler sharpening system with Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, this is Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's expert counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Rodney. Rodney was asking me about the Tumbler USA sharpening system. So what it is it's a round cylinder with diamond abrasive on the face of it. And it comes with a like magnetic block with angles already set. And so the way this sharpener works is you place that angle block on the countertop or cutting board or whatever, and you attach your knife to it, and the magnets hold the knife up against it. And then they show simply rolling the cylinder up and down the blade until the blade is sharp. So, as you may guess, he was wanting to know if it was legit or a good system. And I politely replied back, it's a legit piece of something. Anyways, no. I would not recommend the system. Actually, Jack, I believe, has one. I don't remember if he has the Tumbler brand or another brand. So there was one brand that was original. I don't remember which one it was, and then there's a bunch of knockoffs. The concept is kind of sound like it makes sense that it would kind of work, but the problem is it really has limitations. Any system designed to do a task is designed with, you know, certain parameters involved. But for the application, I don't feel like it's a good purchase. If you're just looking for something, say you only have an 8-inch chef's knife that you want to sharpen and you want to use this system, I think it would do fairly well, like okay, at sharpening that style of knife. But when you start using smaller knives or, you know, whatever, you're going to run into problems. And on top of that, it's not going to do a great job at the heel of the knife and at the tip of the knife. And that is, a lot of these systems are going to struggle sharpening the heel of the knife or the tip of the knife. And even with hand sharpening, those are two areas that the advantage with hand sharpening is you can pinpoint the section of blade that you want to work on. And so if a lot of times when you're sharpening, you'll actually raise a burr on the belly of the knife first. The tip gets used more and the heel, it's harder to concentrate your passes. So what happens is you're either going to start on the tip of your knife or the heel of the knife when you're sharpening. And you start moving as you sharpen down the blade. And so more time gets spent on the belly and the center of the blade than on the heel and the tip. So when we're sharpening, we are going to spend time developing just the heel and just the tip. And that way you can have your knife fully sharpened the way it should be. The other problem I have with like the tumbler type system is as you're dragging that wheel down the table, you've got some abrasives doing like an edge trailing a stroke, and you got some abrasives doing like a leading stroke, and you end up with these more arced sharpening scratches in your blade. The nice thing about hand sharpening is we can decide whether or not we want, you know, how we want that scratch pattern to be and how that we want that burr to form. And then in the middle of that cylinder, if you're doing a knife that's going to kind of fall in the midsection of that tumbling cylinder, you got all sorts of stuff going on. So anyways, all that being said is I think it's kind of a unique way to tackle the problem. But man, you know, I say this time and time again. Just learn the skill of sharpening. And you will not have to rely on any type of system or gadget. It's not that hard. It just requires a little bit of practice. And once you have that skill, it's just going to pay dividends. You're never going to struggle, whether it's a small knife, a large knife, whether it's scissors, no matter what the tool that you need to sharpen, when you learn the skill of sharpening, you are going to be able to sharpen any of these knives, any of these cutting tools that are thrown your way. So, oh yeah, that's probably, so when I was at the Blade Show, I just got back from the Blade Show, there is a Stax heat treating. They were giving out these carbide sharpeners. And I told the guy, I'm like, man, you're killing me. You're killing me. Like, I always tell people not to use these things on their knives. And then I was like, I know what you guys are doing. You're trying to get more business. You want people to destroy their knives so they had to buy more knives and have more knives heat treated. So anyways, these carbide sharpeners, like, in a pinch, if I had nothing else to use, which is almost never, I might use them for something. I went ahead and took one just because, I don't know, just for, to make me laugh or something. I don't know. But this is not the way you want to sharpen your knives. Learn the skill and get good at it, and it will serve you well in the future. I get it. You know, there's just no shortcuts in life. If you want to lose weight, if you want to build muscle, if you want to build a business, if you want to learn how to sharpen knives, there's just no shortcut. Do the work, learn the skill, it'll serve you well. That's all I got. Thanks, Rodney, for the question. If you guys have questions, send them to me. I'll try not to be too hard on you. But this has been Patrick from MT Knives. Have a great day.
So I'll just say that I actually will be a lot more negative even than Patrick was, and I'm wondering, since he knows that I had one, if he just doesn't remember the conversation we had about it, and he's pulling his punches a little bit here because it's a piece of shit and you shouldn't buy it. That's the full answer to it. And let me explain that. If you use it as designed, you can, in fact, get a knife sharp with it, okay? And if you F with it long enough, you'll get pretty decent at using it to make most knives sharp. It will work well for some knives and not as well for others, okay? It will hold the angle you're looking for, but that will not guarantee you success, okay? I can make a knife shave hair using the exposed ceramic rim of the bottom of a coffee cup. So just because it can be used to make a knife sharp does not mean it is a good sharpening system. That is one. Okay. It is designed to look so simplistic that anybody can do it. You slap the knife on the magnet, you roll it back and forth, you get a sharp knife. It doesn't work that way. There's a whole experience coefficient you have to develop with exactly how much pressure and what speed to use, and with different knives, what angle to select. And when you're doing that, you also even need to look at, like, will this knife even work with this angled block that they created? This is just a bunch of shit to it, and you have to work really hard to actually get good at using it. Well, you would be much better off putting the same amount of work in to getting really good at using something like just regular stones, or a lot of other systems that are actually better, even if they're not perfect, than this thing. Because the big flaw this thing has is it has, like, these man-made diamond surface on it, or some sort of carbide surface on it. I don't remember which. Okay, it's still here somewhere, and I don't know where it is. That tells you everything. And they gave it to me. That was when I was playing around TikTok for a while. I encountered them. They reached out. They said, you know, we'd like you to work with us. We'll send you one. They sent it to me. And I'm like, I'm glad I didn't pay for it. All right. The big thing is that carbide or those fake diamonds or whatever the hell it is on that surface that actually puts the edge on the knife, that wears down very, very, very quickly. So that about the time that you actually get good at using this tool to the best of the ability you can, you need to buy a new one because it won't move steel much anymore. I mean, when it shows up, it feels almost like sandpaper, the roughness of it. After probably three or four knives, it's well worn. And after, you know, half a dozen to a dozen sharpenings, especially if that knife really needed an edge reestablished, it's pretty functionally useless. The best thing that it comes with is a leather strop. Well, you can get one of those without buying that thing for $80 or $100 or whatever it is. I personally say do not spend your money on this thing. And that's why even though they were like, here's a free one, we'll do a discount for your members, we want to be a sponsor, I turned these guys down several years ago. So if Patrick, if you pulled any punches, you didn't need to, brother. With that, let's go on and hear about Dogo's Mr. Dog when Mr. Dog has to get in a fight with other dogs because some dog decided to be aggressive with the other dog.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. Okay, today's question comes from Sarah. She was out with her dog walking down the sidewalk. Everything seemed fine. Another person approached with their dog. They seemed to be doing okay. And then all of a sudden, there was a lunge, a bark, and a nip on the other dog. And Sarah wants to know, what do I do about this? And she gave the classic response I always hear from people when this happens, it came out of nowhere. The reality is, it didn't. Dogs are always communicating, and they will always tell you before a bite, a nip, a bark, or a growl happens. The thing is, dogs don't talk, so you have to learn to read your dog's body language in these situations. One of the first things you need to learn as a handler is if your dog is thinking about breaking obedience. Now, this doesn't always apply to aggression. If a dog is supposed to be staying in a place, especially if they're up on a platform or on a dog bed, and they start looking around on the ground for a spot to land, they're thinking about getting out of position. You want to communicate with your dog before they break obedience, if it's possible. Try not to let them break the obedience first. So if I see my dog looking for a place to get down off a table, I go, "Fooey that, you wait." And I let them know, no, I don't want you getting off that table. I want you staying where you are. If I see the dog look up at me or stop looking at the ground, I go, good plutz, good weight. And I'm letting them know you're doing a good job right now. Keep doing that. If you do this consistently, pretty soon your dog's going to start thinking, that person can read my mind. And they'll stop even thinking about disobeying. The second thing you need to do is you have to recognize distractions. A lot of times the dogs will start pulling ahead on a lead or start looking around or getting excited, and most handlers ignore that. Definitely start paying attention to that, and you want to deal with it as soon as it starts to happen. Don't wait until there's a problem. And the third thing handlers usually fail to do is they don't recognize when their dogs are uncomfortable. If children are walking up to your dog asking to pet them and your dog isn't comfortable, don't let your children pet your dog. That's the time when something bad is potentially going to happen. The same thing when a stranger or a strange dog comes up to you and your dog starts to get uncomfortable and they say, oh, can the dogs interact? No, do not allow that. You're responsible for what happens to your dog and you're responsible for what your dog does. Sometimes your dog will seem comfortable at the beginning and then it will start getting uncomfortable. If that happens, I calmly disengage the situation. If it's children, I say something like, all right, that's enough. Thanks for petting the dog. And I'll kind of gently shoo them away from the dog. If there's two dogs interacting and I start seeing my dog get uncomfortable, I go, okay, thanks. And I pull my dog away calmly. I expect them to do the same. I might take some steps back to create distance. Just in case something happens, we can control the situation better. Most of your nips and bites and problems, especially on the aggression side, come from the handler not paying attention to their dog. The dog communicated, the dog told you it was uncomfortable, and you just ignored it. Tell the dog exactly what you want them to do. Leave it. Praise them when they're calm and relaxed. Good, leave it. Everything's okay, just relax. I want to constantly be communicating with my dog in these situations. Basically, what you're doing is you're causing the dog's focus and attention to come off of whatever the distraction is and to focus back on you and to know if you do this thing, everything will be okay. Good seats, good leave it, good wait. But remember, if you start to see something develop, you want to communicate with the dog before something bad happens. Also, if I know my dog has a habit of doing certain behaviors, I want to start looking for what are the patterns or the situations where that behavior occurs, and I want to start dealing with it before we actually get into the situation. So if I know there's a dog coming around the corner that my dog likes to bark at, before my dog even sees the other dog, I'm going to tell my dog, leave it alone, I see it, it's okay. Once the dog comes into view, if my dog barks, I'll correct them and I'll repeat the commands. If my dog stays calm, I'll praise them. Good, leave it. Good, foos. That a boy. I let them know, yes, this is the behavior I want you doing. This is when it's really important to not only have a good grip on your lead, but to know how to use it effectively. And when you do this properly, you're going to notice a difference right away. The dog is going to be more calm and relaxed. You as the handler will be able to relax and calm down because the dog is now under control, and you'll be able to start moving through various environments and distractions without the dog breaking obedience. You're developing a dog that understands that it needs to listen to its handler, do what you say, and if it follows your commands, everything will be okay. You're building trust between you and your dog. If you want a reliable dog that you can trust in almost any environment, it's obedience, but it also starts with you being aware, not just of your environment, but also of your dog and the communication they're giving you. So I hope this was helpful for you. If you'd like more information learning how to train your own dog, check out Canine Academy by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on the Canine Academy banner, and check out the courses that we have there available. And if you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained companion or protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consult button, send us a message, and I'll reach out to you. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So when Joel says that the dog always tells you before the thing's going to happen, that is true, but it's not always possible to have the time between the tell and the action, because in this situation, there's another dog involved. So I don't remember when this email came in all the particulars as to why these two dogs had a bit of a go at each other and one nipped the other one. However, I can tell you that I have had dogs who are completely cool with other dogs, and I still try to avoid this type of introduction because I don't know your dog. So it is completely possible that this person's dog showed zero signs of aggression and the other dog engaged in something that that dog perceived correctly as aggression and responded. And so you have to go beyond observing your dog. You have to observe everything in your area, right? Your area that you're operating in, your AO. And when I see somebody with another dog coming, and I'm like, let's say when we take Belle and we're walking in the nature center, and I see somebody coming with a dog, or sometimes they have two dogs or whatever, I get, as they're coming down the trail, like I look for a spot kind of that's easy to pull off to the side, and I walk several steps off the trail. I put her on the leeward side of me. I tell her to sit and wait, and I let those dogs go by. And when people say things like, oh, they're friendly with other dogs, I say, that's okay. I'm not even willing to risk the integration, because there are so many times that people say things about their own dogs and they're not in touch with what Joel just said, and they have no idea if their dog's uncomfortable. They have no idea whether their dog's going to be aggressive. And either my dog's going to tear the shit out of your dog, or I'm going to kick the shit out of your dog if your dog is getting the upper hand with my dog. I mean, in a perfect example with this was my dog Charlie was an incredibly aggressive animal once that switch flipped. He also never met anybody he didn't like under the right circumstances, including other dogs. But if that other dog bowed up on him and even demonstrated that I am the dominant, he was like, oh, the hell you are. And so, you know, my dog is the kind of dog that if you didn't have like a certain amount of heft to yours, my dog could kill another dog quickly. That dog was a BAMF. And so I didn't want him having that interaction. And a lot of people are like, but I want my dog to be able to interact with other dogs. And that's good, and it's a great goal. But that means that you need knowledge of the other animal, in my opinion. I don't like dog parks. You let all the dogs run and all. I mean, it's going to – the most bites and the most dog fights happen at dog parks. Like, that's just a thing. So I would say you always want to control introductions. You always want to measure both dogs' attitudes toward introductions and look at them. You always want to engage the dogs. And the best way I found to introduce dogs, by the way, is you have two people, and they have their dogs on a leash, and my dog's on my right side, and your dog's on your left side, and you're on my left side, and we will walk those dogs till they're just about ready to quit. They're just about ready to lay down. We will take all that excitement of, oh, there's a new dog, and we'll just do things together until they're just like, oh, well, I guess you were always there. It's kind of like introducing chickens where you stick them in the coop at midnight. They wake up with each other. Oh, I guess you were always there. They don't fight. It's kind of sort of like that. And sometimes you can go much quicker with introductions. Some dogs really are chill. But, you know, when you have both dogs on a leash and you can observe and you know your dog and you know dogs well enough to know the other person's dog, then you can look at an introduction. Passing each other in a park, on the street, walking, just keep them away from each other. That's my opinion, because even if your dog does everything right, the canine brain is wired in such a way that when that other dog shows aggression, the most gentle animal will either, you know, if they're totally baited, they'll just quake in and they can get hurt then by not defending themselves. Or they're going to be like, oh, no, you didn't. And both of those are bad things. Anyway, that's my additions to that one. Now let's hear from Andy. Is it natural? Is it just natural and unavoidable that as we age, we lose muscle and bone mass both? I think to some degree it is eventually. Andy disagrees. Just no. Okay. I think his reasoning is very sound, and I think we actually agree. I think if I said, so are you going to tell me that when you're 97, if you make it that long, you're not going to, well, there's, you know, there's a, yeah, exactly. But I think this idea that we start losing muscle mass in our 50s, that's because we're not using our muscles. I think that's where Andy and I agree here. Andy, let's talk about this condition.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I usually do not hype myself because I feel like we've been talking for a very long time, but some of you guys are brand new and you're like, who is this Andy McCann fool and why does he talk so fast? Well, I don't know why I talk so fast, maybe because I'm kind of Italian, and I'm over here talking with my hands. You just can't see it because you can only listen to me. I have been into this health and fitness genre for over 20 years. I'm an electrical engineer out of Georgia Tech, and I nerded out like crazy on all my troubleshooting stuff and brought that troubleshooting into the health and fitness arena. My personal goal is to be able to coach or be healthy and fit enough to coach my kids' kids in soccer. Now, I don't really care about soccer, but the idea is my kids like me, my kids' kids like me, so I'm not a dick, and I'm healthy and fit so I can move and do a thing that's relatively tough, like coach soccer. It could be anything, but you get the point. So that is me. Here's the thing that I hear a lot, and a question came up at the gym. Andy, tell me about sarcopenia and why, and what is it, and why does it work, or why does it not work, or is it true? Oh, man. So sarcopenia, one of my most hated topics. I can't believe I'm going to talk about this. So basically, they say, hey, is it cause or is it effect, right? Was it corollary or causal? As I get older, I lose muscle mass. I mean, I would say it better like this. As you do nothing for 40 years, you lose muscle mass. So getting older does not mean you're going to lose muscle or bone density. Sarcopenia is actually like, let me pull up the exact definition so I can read it off to you. Oh, my old nemesis reading out loud. Sarcopenia is a progressive muscle skeletal disease characterized by age-related loss of skeletal muscle mass, strength, and physical performance. Whew. Okay, so basically what they're saying is age is making you suck, and that's not true. Age does not make you suck. You sucking makes you suck. If you literally do nothing, your body is going to adapt to that. I think when you look at like these sci-fi novels and they're like, oh, the human race did this and there's other people, but our advantage is we have tenacity or whatever. Like, what is the big thing the human race has over everything else? I think it's adaptability. We got opposable thumbs, so do monkeys, but we adapted to it. We have a brain, right, and we adapted to use that. We've even adapted food to be entertainment, and our body is like, I guess we can live with this. I know ladies who smoke for like 100 years, and they live, like they smoke 5 packs a day and drink a fifth of liquor, right? And they're fine, and they're like 106. You're like, how? Sometimes your body can adapt to extreme cases. Your body is the best thing at adapting to starvation, too much, like if there's too much sun, you get more melanoma, right? If you, again, starvation, you have no food, your body is going to shut things off. Your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. So, sarcopenia is the, oh, it's age-related muscle loss and, like, bone density loss and all this stuff. No, it's, I haven't done anything for the last 30 years. So, of course, your body is going to adapt to that. So, if you're not lifting, then there's no stressors on your body, and your body is going to reduce to make it easy to live. So if you sit all day, your body is going to adapt to that motion. Your legs will tighten up. Your tendons will get shorter, right? So no, you're not losing muscle because you're getting older. You're losing muscle because you're doing nothing, and that's a problem. If you're only jogging or walking, then you're only going to get those sort of things. This is why I tell people all the time, if I could pick only one thing, I would have you back squat. Actually, I'd probably do a thruster, but most of you don't know what that is. I would do a back squat. Why? Because you're going to go below parallel. It's a great thing for health and fitness is to keep that stability and mobility. And two, you can load up significantly heavy on a back squat or go lighter and do a lot of reps. So it's a very good movement. There's strength. There's some cardio in there if you want it to be. And there's a range of motion thing. It's going to assist. Now, is it true that Andy McCann, who's been doing CrossFit for 20 years, is weaker than I was when I was like 35. The answer is yes. I cannot deadlift or bench press or strict press or back squat the same amount of weight that I could a long time ago. But my skill sets have gone up. My clean and jerk and my snatch, which are Olympic lifts and they're a more skilled movement, have actually gone up by 1 pound. So am I weaker? Yeah. Am I more skilled? Yes. Do I look the same? And that's the real interesting part. I look about the same, except I'm less puffy in the middle because I don't eat sugar or grains. Actually, I only eat carnivore. I eat like less than one carb a day. That's a whole story where my son was trying to fix his Crohn's diagnosis with environment and lifestyle and food and so forth. So, and it's been going great. A lot of you guys text and email about that, and I do appreciate that. Anyway, so sarcopenia, age-related muscle loss, bone density loss, all that stuff. You're not losing because you're getting older. You're losing that stuff because you're a dumbass and you're not doing anything and your body is going to adapt to it. You need to treat your body as a vehicle in this life, whatever you believe. It is the vehicle that your consciousness, whatever, rides in, and you need to maintain it. If you don't, it's going to reduce down to whatever it needs to be the most efficient. I guess that's what I would say. Your body is adaptable, but it's the most efficient device ever created. It responds to the stimulus around you. So push it a bit. All right, guys, yes, I hate this topic, but if you need help, I'm here for you. You can find me at CrossFitGarage.com or Andy at CrossFitGarage.com. Or you can watch videos or podcasts. I have a podcast of my own, Fitness, Food, and Finance, and I'm on YouTube, Andy at, I butchered that one, at Andy McCann 42. Anyway, y'all take care.
So as I said in the intro, I agree fully with the spirit of what Andy's saying there, and this is not inevitable at the level we accept it at, I guess is the way that I would put it. I think that, yeah, you know, I've seen guys that work out well into their late 80s, and they look in amazing shape for 88, let's say, or 86 or 87. And that's great. And I mean, if you want to do it, you should do it. And I think more of us should do it. What I am going to say, though, is there isn't an 88-year-old who is in anything approaching decent shape in his 40s. That is as physically fit as he was in his 40s. And that there is some bone and muscle mass loss as we age. That is a part of aging. You can see it in even very healthy and active elderly people. That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Like, there is, eventually your heart stops and you die. So there has to be some decline. No one lives forever. And, it's actually very rare for people to make it very far into their hundreds. And it's actually really rare for most people to make it any significant level into their 90s. So there is a point of decline. I just think what we've taken is a real thing that as we age, we do at some point begin to lose some bone and muscle mass. And we've made it an excuse for our own ineptitude and inaction. And I think that's where Andy and I completely agree. Anyway, let's talk about antibiotics now with bones. It used to be you could just buy big old bottles of, you know, tetracycline, amoxicillin, whatever. They call it fish mox or whatever. It's the same shit. But the FDA eventually closed that loophole. And now you can get, you know, this stuff for your fish, but you get like one capsule. You can't buy a bottle of it anymore. And so with that in mind, what is a person to do that wants to have an emergency stockpile of antibiotics?
Hi, Joel Nandi here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net and AltonFirstAid.com. Today's question comes from Derek, who writes, could you please refresh your advice about stocking up on antibiotics? My understanding is that pet antibiotics are no longer available, or at least not in the way they used to be. I came across this site, which looks legitimate but more expensive. He references Ozio, OZIO.com. Do you have a package you would recommend? Also, do you recommend including ivermectin or anything similar? It would also be helpful to know which antibiotics are typically used for which kinds of issues. Thank you, Derek. Derek, I'll start by saying that my writings have always been meant for circumstances where there is no functioning medical system. So the advice as to which antibiotics I recommend hasn't changed, only now mentioned in their generic name, not the old fish brand. These can all be found in my 2020 Book Excellence Award-winning book, Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, The Layman's Guide, although some of the images in the book may still show the fish version. Ignore those images if you have an edition that does, because the written content is still relevant. Now, I was of the same understanding as you as to the availability of fish antibiotics, but to be sure, I decided to do a deep dive using AI to see what the current situation was. To my surprise, yes, several specialty pet suppliers and online retailers still offer fish antibiotics, apparently without a prescription. Major retailers like Petco and Amazon have restricted the sale of these oral medications, but you can still find them through certain online vendors and feed stores. Companies and platforms that still appear to offer over-the-counter fish antibiotics include Fine Pet Health, which acts as the official U.S. dealer for the Aquasoma Labs Fix line, F-I-X, which replaced the once dominant Thomas Labs. They offer antibiotics like amoxicillin, doxycycline, and cefalexin. Pittsboro Feed is an agricultural supply store that carries fish antibiotics online for nationwide shipping. Calvet Supply offers a variety of over-the-counter fish biotics products. And Hardy Paw supplies a range of over-the-counter fish medications as well. There are more. You might have to search the sites a bit, and they all have some kind of disclaimer that goes like this. Fish antibiotics are intended exclusively for ornamental and aquarium fish. Health organizations and regulatory agencies such as the FDA strongly warn against human consumption of these products. They lack human-grade regulation and purity testing. Before, when I first wrote about fish antibiotics, this was not true, as they were just human antibiotics repackaged for the aquarium hobby. Today, you might have to do your own research and reach your own conclusions. There are several human companies you can buy antibiotics through, none of which I have any affiliation with. They include Ozio, the company you mentioned, also the wellness company, Jace, and others. They sell kits with various medicines, and each kit is similar, honestly, to each other, but not identical. Their base kits are similarly priced, between, I guess, $200 to $300, and some have add-ons that you can choose to buy, and some have elaborate larger kits that are more expensive. One of the most frequent questions I receive from readers, listeners, and viewers is which antibiotics to have on hand for survival settings. In my Antibiotics and Infectious Disease book, I discuss, well, antibiotics and infectious bacterial diseases most commonly expected in survivors knocked off the grid, and the antibiotics that can cure them. Certainly it would be great if you had the financial resources to have all of the antibiotics we talk about in Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, but that's beyond the means of almost everyone. You'll probably need to pick a limited number to stockpile, but which ones? Chances are, if you've lined up 10 doctors, you'll get 10 different answers. But each of the companies I mentioned have at least 4 of the 6 antibiotics that I would want to have in times of trouble. Your choices would depend on the infections you're most likely to encounter. Is it wound infections you're concerned about, or intestinal infections like dysentery or cholera? Does someone in your group have a medical condition that makes them prone to a certain infection? Certainly, one drug doesn't cure all. Without knowing your individual situation, I can't give you specifics. I can, however, still give you my personal recommendations of a few antibiotics available that would be assets in my survival medicine cabinet. This short audio would be too long to mention every disease these drugs treat or their dosing. Our book is more than 300 pages long, but I'll mention a little bit about each. For those who aren't allergic to penicillin, I think having either amoxicillin or cephalexin, both members of the beta-lactam family, would be good drugs to have around, especially for soft tissue and bacterial upper respiratory infections. Dosing is certainly simple and in most cases safe for pregnant and pediatric patients. There's also amoxicillin with clavulanic acid, which is effective against some infections that are resistant to amoxicillin alone. Another antibiotic I would have is doxycycline, which handles a lot of different infections of the respiratory and intestinal tracts, and is okay to take if you're allergic to penicillin drugs, although it isn't considered acceptable for use during pregnancy. For those who claim doxycycline becomes toxic when expired, I want you to note that the Department of Defense's Shelf Life Extension Program has in the past authorized its use well beyond the expiration dates. Metronidazole is a drug I would consider very useful, especially for intestinal infections from bacteria and certain parasites like Giardia, seen in intestinal and pelvic infections as well. It has also been used in those with serious infections, for example, early appendicitis, combined with another antibiotic, and for situations where surgery isn't an option. Although metronidazole is acceptable in those allergic to penicillin, it's not okay for pregnant or breastfeeding mothers. Azithromycin is known to be generally safe in pregnancy, as well as those with penicillin allergies. It can deal with many cases of respiratory infection, dysentery, tonsillitis, sinusitis, and more. An additional benefit is that many have taken it before in its popular Z-Pak form. The sulfadrug combination of sulfamethoxazole and trimethoprim is an excellent choice for many infections, including urinary ones. If that is a common problem for family members, you might consider this drug. It's also been used for skin infections, some sinusitis, MRSA, ear infections, and others. Sulfadrugs are acceptable in the penicillin allergic, but not in the pregnant woman or breastfeeding mother. Clindamycin would also be on my list. It has been used to treat everything from acne to anthrax, but is helpful for pneumonias, pelvic infections, uterine infections after childbirth, soft tissue infections, and is even effective against MRSA. It is, unlike doxycycline and metronidazole, acceptable for use during pregnancy and in people allergic to penicillin. Of course, you could be allergic to clindamycin or any other antibiotic itself. In rare cases, use of clindamycin could induce an intestinal inflammation known as colitis, which could be serious. Then there's ivermectin, in its human form and not the paste used for horses. It's certainly an option in the age of COVID. You may notice I haven't mentioned ciprofloxacin, or Cipro, an important antibiotic which is effective against many infections. I feel that the side effects of the drug, including damage that causes weakness in the muscles and tendons, precluded my recommendation. It's still an option for some. In our book, Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, we describe the various antibiotic families in detail. The drugs I've mentioned each belong to a different family, and if you can accumulate some of each over time, it would give you the best chance of having a medicine on hand that would have activity against almost any bacterial infection. The main disadvantage of buying from the human antibiotic companies that I mentioned, well, is that you're often limited in the quantity of the drugs in question you can purchase and the frequency of purchases. For the medic in charge of a large survival group, this could be problematic. It's important for you to know that every single medication that I've mentioned has its share of side effects and reasons why they might be dangerous in some people, like those with kidney or liver disease. You should also learn to recognize the signs and symptoms of all the various infections. Indeed, antibiotics aren't useful at all if you've misdiagnosed a viral infection as a bacterial one. Antibiotics aren't candy, and they should be used judiciously and rarely in survival settings. They will be scarce commodities, irreplaceable in a societal collapse, so accumulate a good supply and utilize them wisely. To accomplish that goal requires not just monetary funds, but a fund of knowledge and good judgment. If you're successful, you might save the life of someone that otherwise might not survive in times of trouble. This is Joel Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And while you're at it, consider Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, a Layman's Guide. Plus, get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at altonfirstaid.com or store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So, good stuff from Doc. We'll let that speak for itself. Let's talk about how AI may impact the already in decline university system in America. I keep saying dying, and that's not the right word, unless we're going to talk about it dying as you know it, where, you know, every town of any reasonable size has at least one small private college in it, and there's, you know, thousands of colleges, and, you know, the goal in life of the average high schooler is to go to college, and everybody continues to believe in everybody should go to college, and the magical fantasy land, and schools continuing to boast, you know, 82% of our graduates last year went on to college, right? That is going to die. That is not going to continue to exist. That has been an artificial construct that was created with fiat money, specifically exploded, as you might guess, in 1971, and has been only made worse over the years as the ability and capacity of schools to expand their offerings of degree programs and the size of their schools and their benefits and their services and all has been almost unlimited. But yet you need a certain number of students to sign their life away to a loan to come to your school to maintain that. And so about the 1990s, colleges began systematically reducing admission standards. And it has gotten worse every decade since, to where right now people that should not even be allowed to, like, take the garbage out as a janitor at a university can get a degree there. And that's fundamental reality. And a system like that, sooner or later, no matter how much artificial life support you give it with fiat funds and guaranteed loans, it has to break. Because it's all fake until Billy or Tammy or Susie or Scott graduates with his so wonderfully sought after degree trinket and goes to find a job and finds out the only jobs he can get he could have got without a degree at all. Or the jobs he can get because he has a degree don't pay much more or have much more advancement opportunity than jobs he could have gotten without a degree at all. Or she could have gotten without a degree at all. And their sisters and brothers who are 10 years their junior have watched this occur, and now they're sophomores and juniors in high school, and mom and dad are pushing them to go to college, and they're like, I don't think so. Because big sis works at Starbucks. And if I want to get a job at Starbucks, I can just, like, literally go do that shit right now while I'm still in high school. So I got to see more out of this. So that's been a natural decline. On top of it, we've talked about this before, but we have had the enrollment cliff, which is no longer coming. It's now here, and it's about a 20-year cycle of down, 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 plateau, plateau, plateau. And then if everything restores itself and you have this, you know, kind of people having more babies 20 years from now, begins to rise. But what happens between now and the next 20 years that doesn't leave much opportunity for that to happen either. Not because we won't start having babies again, because I believe that's a natural flow and people do it. It's going to be more that, well, do you need, like, as we atrophy away from this, why would we rebuild it as its current model? So now let me give you the promised four classifications. And I think these break up into roughly quarters. Roughly 25%, you know, one might be 28 and one might be 23 or whatever, but I think about 25% of people that go to college have made a fantastic decision for their long-term well-being. The degree that they pursue is valuable. the skill sets the degree develops are in demand, and they end up working in their field or closely related to their field for the majority of their working life, and their income because of their degree reflects a good value to price ratio in that they're able to service the debt on their degree, and they end up better off than if they didn't have the degree, right? That's the story we get about the majority, but I think it's only 25%. I think 25% of people are somewhat benefited. The job they get doesn't necessarily require the degree that they have, but it really, up till now, most likely required a degree. In other words, to get past HR Karen, the HR Karen squad, they had to have that box checked. And so they might end up, you know, with, they might have a degree in X and a career in Y that's not even related to X, and they might do fairly well in that career. They may not be heavily aided in it by their degree. Their promotions, et cetera, may not come very fast because of the mismatch, but they would have never gotten a start without it. So that's half of all people that go having a clear benefit. You know, half of those, that half has a very clear benefit, and the other half has kind of this murky, it really did at least get me in the door and get me a job and get me a start, and I built a career. I didn't need college for it, but I needed a college for a shot at it. There's people like me that break that because we wormed our way in without a degree, but we are the minority. You know, I don't want to go into survivor bias here, but it's important that people like me don't get into too much survivor bias, right? Okay, then you get the next 25%. These are people, and I'm only talking about graduates. I'm not even talking about all the people that wash out that have, like, you know, a year and a half of school and they just wasted their money and now they have debt and no degree. I'm talking about only graduates here. Then we have about another 25% of people who their life works out so well that even though their degree does nothing for them, they're able to basically service whatever debt they have. And they're reasonably happy about their decision to go to school because their life is not completely miserable. Maybe they have some animosity toward their degree, but because they've done well enough, even if they did well enough without the degree actually playing a role in it, they are able to convince themselves that it sort of kind of did and that they really would do it again, and they don't completely hate their life for having pursued a degree. Okay, but their degree played no real role in their success. They were just capable of success anyway. And then you have the bottom 25. These are people whose degree plays no role in their success. And because they went to school and because they expected success from the degree alone, they never actually develop any significant success. And when they're 40 years old, they're still screaming it's not fair and the government should pay their loan off for them. That's your four groups. Now, we put AI into this because what's happening in this article is that people are using AI and gaming the system, but they're actually learning the work enough because in these degree programs, you don't just submit, you know, something you wrote. You don't just take online multiple choice tests where you can look up the answers in real time. There are some hard graded and proctored type exercises that the person has to prove they can actually do. So I'm not saying that they cheat their way through. What they're doing is they're massively accelerating their way through a lot of the bullshit work, the fluff that goes into these degree programs to make them last 4 years. Because most degree programs do not require 4 years. In fact, even in the article, they talk about how a lot of schools have said, yeah, you're right, you don't need like a French literature course or an art appreciation course for your degree in business management. So a lot of these schools have already, even in traditional degree paths, they're issuing a four-year degree, a bachelor's degree with 3 years of courses at a full-time rate, not the people that, you know, get through in 3 years because they take classes during winter and fall break and they take classes during summer break and all that. Like they're literally like you just go do a full-time schedule, 3 years, you're done. That's an admission that 25% of what they're charging you for you don't need. Just in case you don't know. When you add AI to the mix, everything speeds up. But the guy that wrote the LinkedIn post that spawned this segment is actually coming at it more from my angle. If I can use AI to do the job that you need me to do, Do you care whether or not I have a degree in reality, not your HR legacy requirements, right? But do the person employing me, do they really care about the fact that I have some bullshit degree in bubblegum studies or something so that they can tick a box? And again, a lot of legacy environments, that's still a requirement. It can often be circumvented, but it's still there. But do they really care? And how long can that legacy hold on? And it's only a matter of time before in a lot of these companies, key decision makers rise up through the ranks in non-traditional education programs. And they have no, see, there's a whole thing where these people, that like, they're like the lead HR Karen for a giant company. And, you know, they report directly to somebody in the C-suite. And you know, like the CPO now, because they've invented new C-level officers because they just need to spend more money, I guess. So like your HR director reports directly to the CPO. And both of them have degrees from snooty institutions. And so they have this value that they have, this this fraternity or sorority value, even if they weren't in a true fraternity or sorority house. What I mean is that there is this whole, hey, we went to Brown or we went to Harvard or Princeton or even someplace like Penn State or Texas A&M. These schools have a lot of alumni associated value to them. And then so, but you don't have my prestigious university, but you have at least a degree, so I value that. So these people are able to hold the line in this degree requirement, and there's a surplus of people with degrees. As that surplus wanes, and as decision makers are not always people with those built-in, bolted-on biases, because they have one too, because like when I was running a company, I didn't give a shit if you went to school or not. I hired a guy with a degree from SMU, and I didn't find out he had a degree from SMU till a year after I hired him. He's like, it's on my resume. And I said, well, I don't screen resumes. I have people for that. I interviewed you on like your final interview after the person that works for me that you work for said you were worth interviewing, and I don't care. It doesn't matter. And what's your degree in? And the guy looks at me and says, marketing. Now, SMU's expensive. And they supposedly have a great marketing program. This guy was a great web developer, a good coder, a decent programmer. And that's what I hired him to do. This guy could not have marketed freaking water to somebody waddling through the Sahara Desert. He had no marketing acumen at all, but he had a degree in marketing. This all adds up to now you're giving me a tool. You're giving me a tool that I can give to my people. My people can use this tool to develop themselves and to accelerate their own education. See, I think these people aren't all cheating their way through a four-year degree in, you know, 6 months. I think what they're actually doing is they're accelerating their ability to progress through the degree because they're unbothered by fluff and distraction. And it just really doesn't take that long. You know, when my grandkids were doing homeschool, most days they were able to knock out a day's work in 2 hours, but the school system has them for 7 to 9 hours. What are they doing with them for the other 5 or 6 hours? Indoctrinating them. Wasting their time. Moving them around for the purpose of moving them around so they learn how to respond to a bell, Pavlovian style. That's what. And how do we know that's the case? Well, we know that's the case because you take kids like my grandkids. They do 5 years homeschool. One gets dropped in as a freshman, the other one in the middle of grade school, back into public school because they both, basically my grandson wanted to go back because he wanted to play baseball, and my granddaughter wanted to go because brother went. That's how simple that was, right? And both of them are like, you know, A, like my grandson's an A student, my granddaughter's a 3.5 student. And they had 2-hour-a-day homeschool for 5 years, and yet they can drop right into that system and immediately do work commensurate with their peers, where many of their peers can't do the work. So is the time really a requirement? The answer is no. So now let's look at it from a, let's look at it. Remember we talked about incentives with Charlie Munger. Show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Okay. Now look at it from a company's viewpoint. If I can accelerate the time it takes for a person to come work for me, and while I'm accelerating it, I get a more qualified employee who's less burdened by debt so that they are happier with the money that I pay them? You think I don't want that? Are you smoking crack? Really? Like, did you lace your crack with meth? Right? Like, what am I missing? If I'm an employer and I can hire somebody even that not only that's more qualified, maybe I can even pay them just a little bit less. And the reason I can pay them a little bit less is they need less, and people have a threshold, especially new, like when you're, I'm talking about starting workers. Starting workers generally have a survival threshold. So everybody would love to make 150 grand a year out of the gate or more, right? You're not gonna. You're gonna be paid shit in the beginning because you are shit, because you're on the bottom, because you haven't proven yourself yet. And that's the way it is. And if you don't like it, Gen Z, buck up. It's how it was for the millennials. It's how it was for my generation, Gen X. It's how it was for the boomers that you hate today. And you have no idea why you hate them other than social media and the TV told you to. It's how your grandparents or great-grandparents in the silent generation started and how their parents in the GI generation started. Everybody starts at the bottom, and the bottom sucks, okay? But there is a, I cannot survive below this level of income that sets a floor on that because the employer will raise the rate to the level that people will actually say yes to the job. That's how that works, okay? That's the old George Carlin, that people are paid just enough to keep them from quitting, right? Right, they're paid just enough so they don't quit, right? And well, they also pay just enough so they'll come to work in the first place. And so if I can move that number down a little bit, because a person that comes to work for me with $100,000 of student loan debts knows that their survival base is higher than someone with zero. Or that it was $5,000. See how that works? So there is a survival base number to income. And if that number can be lowered, and it can, and if I can accelerate the speed at which I can get an employee ready to come work for me, and I can accelerate their time to being productive, all those incentives align with corporate America. And that's why your biggest growth sectors right now have been governmental and quasi-governmental, because the industrial sector, and when I say industrial, I don't necessarily mean, you know, melting copper. I mean everybody that's not government or quasi-government, they're profit-based. And they overhired in the era of cheap money, and they borrowed money, and they had tax-free cash flow out the ass. And that era has come to an end, and it's been gone for 5 years. And they now have to adapt to, you need to make money or you are going to go under. And so their incentive is to hire the person who will work for the least and do the best, which it always has been. It's just more clear now. And now you have another alternative route. So what does that do to your four groups of people? The 25% that are just basically functional dummies. They get degrees that are useless, and then their careers are useless. They'll probably keep going until there's no money available for them because they're people that are just stalled in life and they don't know what else to do. Some portion of them may wake up and realize what their inner genius is and take an alternative route, which is what I would advise them to do. But I think mostly that group will be largely ineffective in the next 10 years. The only thing about it is the total population shrinks for the enrollment cliff. So the number goes down, but the percentage group stays about where it is. The 25% that highly benefit from the university system, these are your doctors, your lawyers, your high-level engineers, your MIT-type engineers. Maybe they didn't go to MIT, but they're that type of person, right? Your STEM group people. The people that the work they do in college is legitimately applicable to the work they will do in their careers. Again, doctors, lawyers, etc., engineers. That group will be largely unaffected. They will continue to go to school. Their degree programs may be accelerated by AI. I mean, literally, the education system for K-12 that we used for our grandchildren, Acelus University, is called Acelus because their entire program is built on something called Learning Accelerator. It literally speeds up the capacity of a student to learn and retain information. using a lot of things that have been automated by AI that they already had before they were automated. Yeah? That's why over 6,600 public schools use Acelus programs at public school. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? So I think, but anyway, the upshot is those two groups, I think, would be your most stable groups. Your people who their degree is sort of kind of related, but they really didn't need it, but they did really well. And those are your really smart people who don't want to be doctors and lawyers and nuclear physicists. Okay. They're the people that they come out with, you know, a bachelor's in business administration, which is pretty generalized in that sector. And then they end up specializing in something once they find a career that is somewhat business oriented. And they're good. They're intelligent. They're problem solvers. They're aggressive. The reason it works out for them isn't that the degree was magic. These are the people the degree got them in the door, and then they capitalized on being in the door. Those people are going to drastically shrink as they learn to use AI in either online-based education, boot camps, or straight up, I'm going to figure out what the kind of company I want to work for needs. I'm going to develop the skill set myself in 4 months. I'm going to prove that, and I'm going to find my way in the door. That is going to hit the college system hard because these are the intelligent, hardworking students that generally pay their bills. These are the examples that they want to give to bring in the other two groups below them. You can't use the doctor and the lawyer and the engineer to get the person with an 81 IQ who you will let in who should never be in to go to college. They don't know, they don't ever think they're going to be a doctor or an engineer. They want to take some easy bullshit because the guidance counselor said they would get a good job if they did, and they want to party their way through school, and they'll put like minimal effort, and they want to get B's with minimal effort. Those are the recruit, that's where you're recruiting in your bottom half, those people. Aimless, driftless, directionless, but their parents are going to push them in the right direction. Their students are going to push them in the right direction. They'll sign their life away. So now we're down. We got the bottom quarter and the top quarter largely unaffected. We get the middle top, right, on that one side at like 50 to 74%. Those people drastically reduced. So what about the 26 to 49% or 26 to 50%, that bottom middle quarter? They are also going to drastically cut back on how many of those people go to college in the traditional sense. These are also smart people. These are often people who end up in trade jobs anyway, who were right for trades, but were steered into the education system, and they got a degree in something, but it really didn't pay that well, and it didn't really open up that many doors, but maybe they got into a company and they figured out that, you know, there's good money in being a pipe fitter or an electrician, or they end up in some job where they're overseeing people in trades for a company or something like that, and they just never really needed a degree for it. They're going to find alternatives. Again, these are your smart people. These aren't stupid people. Just because they're in the lower third, that's not ranked on IQ. The bottom quarter kind of is the bucket that your low IQ people fall into. I'm sorry, but it is. The other three, these are generally smart people. These are generally people with IQs between like 100 and 150. That's a wide spectrum. But there's plenty of people with a 110 with an advanced degree. And there's plenty of people with no degree or that kind of middle tier degree that have IQs of 130. Yeah, which 132 and above is considered a genius. That's Mensa level. So you have all these people, but it's the middle 50 that are going to crumble in numbers. And that now, because of the AI advantage, is going to be accelerated. It's like pouring gas on not just a fire, but a barn burner of a fire. Like, this was a fully involved structure, and when the fire truck showed up and it said AI fire unit, and they pulled out the giant hose and two guys grabbed it and started spraying it, it turned out there was diesel fuel in the tank. And so it doesn't explode like gasoline, but it just builds and builds and builds and builds and burns hotter and faster and longer than it ever was going to. And that is what is going to happen to the education system. Everything that I always said was going to happen, but now it will be accelerated, just like dumping accelerant on a fire. And so the question you have to look at, if you have kids heading in that direction, you know, kids that are in high school, that are heading toward college years, what should they really be doing? And I don't have a good answer, because they could be the people that naturally fit in that top 25% group. And I wouldn't steer them away from a system that will work for them. Just because the system is dying as we know it doesn't mean the top end of that system will continue to function. That's the part of the system that was in place for hundreds of years before magical fantasy land is what college was turned into in the 1970s and the 60s to a degree. That's where it all went wrong. If you go back, 1950 and back, you're more into the neighborhood of about 25 to 35% of people went to college. And that's about how many need to go. Because there are things that for now, even with the dawn of AI, we are better suited sending those people off to that type of learning institution. But the other 70-odd percent have no business even being there. Not because they're not in, you know, like they're bad people or they shouldn't be allowed. It's that it doesn't benefit them. People should be following their own personal incentives. Instead, we are following the incentives society has convinced us are in our best interest. But whose best interest are they really in? The purpose of the system is what it does. So I'm not going to answer this one for you. You answer it for yourself over the weekend. Who most benefits from large numbers of people pursuing degrees when those people do not directly benefit from those degrees, and those people end up deeply in debt, and those people end up enslaved in the system and working harder and longer than they ever would have had to had they not gone into that degree path in the first place? Who benefits from that? Now, the obvious answer is the colleges and the banks. But think deeper. Go further. Realize there's a large number of groups that fit that description. People who benefit. Who are they and how do they benefit? Once you understand that, you'll understand not just that system in of itself, but you'll understand a great deal more about our larger socioeconomic system, and you'll understand why I'm probably going to be talking on Tuesday about how in danger this country is right now of heading headlong into socialist hellhole. I really think we have a severe concern when we look at like what just happened in New York with how many of these freaking Zohar Mandami, the retarded socialist Marxist endorsed candidates, just won the primaries for the United States House of Representatives. It's one thing when New York City turns itself into a socialist shithole. It's another thing when they start sending socialist shitheads to D.C. to make law that people in Texas and Florida and Georgia have to live under. Because that's what's happening right now. And this is happening all over the place. So ask yourself again, when we saddle all these young people with ridiculous amounts of debt, convince them that they're highly educated when they can't actually do anything, what are the groups that benefit? How do they benefit? And how does that adversely affect you? And what do you need to do about it to adapt to it? Those are your questions to ponder over the weekend. With that, I will wrap up. I want to thank you guys for tuning in today. If you want to learn how to adapt, make sure on Tuesday next week, which is when we'll be back with a new episode, that you pick up Laws of Life, Book 2 by me, myself, and I, Jack Spirico, subtitle, Now Build the System for Your Life. And again, if you can help me make that kind of a big splash on Amazon, I would really appreciate it. You know, pick up a copy for your nephew or your niece. If you have a kid that's thinking about what to do with their life and they're like in their mid-teens or a little bit older, pick up a copy for them. Don't give this book to a 12-year-old. They're probably not going to like it, and there's probably some content that's a little bit age inappropriate for that young. 14, 15 and older, I would tell you if they can't handle it or you don't want them to see it, that's probably a you issue, not a book issue. Anyway, with that, I appreciate everybody tuning in this week. Again, also remember you can help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. Brought some pretty cool stuff to you guys this week for items of the day. One was the Olight Arcfield Ultra EDC flashlight. This is one of the best flashlights on the planet. And it was on a Prime Day sale, which it still is for now. I don't think this is going to last much longer. $71.99 for a light that normally sells for $120. And this is the light that I carry and two of my best friends in the world carry. And we all came to the conclusion on our own. It does UV. It does a laser pointer. It does a very bright LED light at three settings so you can preserve battery. And the way it charges is just slick. It is 40% off this week. I brought you some other stuff this week as well, including the Black Flag window traps for flies. These are awesome. No poison, no toxins. No one's going to get sick. They use basically a sticky glue. They stick in your window. They do have something in them that like attracts the flies like a scent. But really what attracts the flies is once one or two go in, then they all go in. As I said earlier when I talked about these, you do want to use a little bit of scotch tape when you put them in the little back peel tape thing on them. Sucks. They're worth having anyway. And get them straight into the corner. Look how I have it installed in the window. And if you are having flies in your home because it's been a wet summer, this will get rid of them. And it will break that cycle really, really fast. And you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. Take care, guys. I'll catch you next week with a new episode. And it's probably going to be kind of a barn burner episode on Tuesday. Barn burner was a term my granddad used to use for thunderstorms in August. Right? It's going to be a real barn burner, he would say. It just means it's going to be white hot. We are going to probably talk on Tuesday next week about the unfortunate direction this country is heading into, how we got headed in that direction, and what, if anything, we can do about it. Because I don't know that it can be stopped at this point. I know voting harder won't stop it, and I know that I always poo-poo voting because I don't think my vote matters, and it really doesn't, and mathematically you can't change that. But democracy can be dangerous. In fact, maybe we will call Tuesday show the dangers of democracy. And if you're going to shriek at me, but we're a republic. We are a republic and we are a democracy. We're not a direct democracy. And democracy may really be the problem here, not the solution, because we are not the republic we were intended to be. We are not the old republic. Tune in Tuesday to learn more on that. And again, pick up a copy of my new book.
Traded the sales tie and the corporate grind for muddy boots and that Texas sunshine. Dorothy by his side on a 3-acre spread, 9-mile farmstead where the good life gets fed. 18 years of pockets dropping truth every day, helping you live better, tough times or not. That's what he'd say. Calls himself a redneck hippie duck farmer, y'all, with a jerk of a smile. Standing tall, redneck hippie duck farmer, down on 9 Mile Way, biochar in the garden like a bomb shelter for the clay. Ducks on the pond, pastured eggs in the pan, food forest growing while he lends a helping hand. Ditch the system, design your life, that's the law he wrote. Stacking silver, stacking fat, shotgun by the door. Showing us how to live it right. Biochar's a coral reef for the critters down deep. Bioreactor compost turning scraps into gold. We keep ducks, do the work, fertilize, forage, keep the pests away. Regenerative magic on the good old Texas clay. Guns and hunting wisdom from the fathers before. When the fiat hits the floor, AI on the horizon, but he keeps his boots on the ground. Living off the land while the whole world spins around.
station up in Estes Park snow. He's up at 5 a.m. writing Laws of Life, don't you know? Book one.
Ditch the system.
Design it your own way.
A mill, build the system.
Work it every day.
Preparedness ain't crazy, it's just being grown. Responsible adulting in the world we've been shown. Charlie and Max on patrol.
Set us free.